Well, it must have been quite a contrast in style of living to move from a little village in England suddenly to Hyderabad. How did you and Elsa adjust to that?
Well, of course, we'd had some previous experience of living in Hyderabad together, and that made it very much easier to make the decision to go back. Initially, we lived as we had done when I was there on my sabbatic in one of the flats that they have for visiting workers on the ICRISAT campus, which is quite a large campus. It is about a mile and a half wide and 5 or 6 miles long. So, there was plenty of room for driving around in the evenings if we wanted to get away from the main building area. But most of the expatriate staff, of course, lived in town, and many of them in a very nice area of new houses that have been developed on the west side of Hyderabad, that's the ICRISAT side, in fact, on a very rocky, stony ridge called Jubilee Hills. And I think that a lot of the money for building the very superior houses that were appearing there came from expatriate Indians, so-called non-resident Indians, who invested money that they made abroad this way. And they built houses that were of a far higher standard than we could ever have afforded back home. And we ended up in a beautiful new house which had 5 bedrooms, each with its own ensuite bathroom, and a spiral marble staircase. the only snag about it initially was that it had been built literally right down on top of the solid rock. So to make the garden, they brought along, first of all, about 3 feet of black vertisol, and then they dumped some red soil on top. And within 4 or 5 years, we had trees that were 30 or 40 feet high.
Good heavens.
We had a gardener, of course, who came every day, and a group of household servants who looked after us extremely well. It was really like the old days of the Raj. We felt a bit guilty about it, but we were providing employment for local people, so it was nothing to feel ashamed about, and we were on very good terms with them. They were very friendly, and our whole experience of India domestically was really extremely good. Professionally, it was very good too. I had a very good group of colleagues who worked hard and enthusiastically. And I was really sorry to leave them and say goodbye to them. I'm still in touch with one or two of them. But after 5 years, we felt that there was a danger of losing touch with the scientific community back home, and we were missing our family too, of course. We had one grandchild born in Malaysia while we were there, and another two back home in Britain. So there was a very big family draw to go back. And at the end of 1991, we had a final short tour in northern India, and then got the plane back to Edinburgh.
So you came back to Scotland, to Edinburgh in 1992, and I know a number of us thought it was going to be great to have you back, and you'd probably just settle down quietly into semi-retirement, and we'd see you a little bit from time to time. Well, it didn't turn to be quite as quiet as that, did it?
No, fortunately it didn't. I had hoped to go on developing one or two lines of research that were unfinished when I got back, but I hadn't really expected that I would be employed again. And I was extremely fortunate that just about that time, NERC was setting up its TIGER program, Terrestrial Initiative in Global Environmental Research, and several people wrote me into their research proposals, in some cases consulting me in advance, and in other cases not. So that, as things worked out, three of these proposals succeeded, and I found myself with 6 months of my salary paid by NERC through UTIS, the NERC unit for thematic information systems, led by Robert Gurney, with whom I had worked, of course, when I was in NASA. Another 1 month with Paul Jarvis in forestry at the University of Edinburgh, and another month with Melvin Cannell and his colleagues at Bush.
Well, at least it wasn't sort of 18 months, but, yeah, which right. It looked like at one stage.
Not quite. But this sounds very messy, but in fact it was sorted out very conveniently for me. There was an office for me at Bush. You had kindly provided an office, of course, in the interregnum between leaving Sutton Bonington and going out to India at the time when you were in charge there and we were finishing off together the second edition of Principles of Environmental Physics. So a lot of my books and papers were still there in somewhat chaotic order. And I had a nice little office, which I think was one that you used at one
right,
time earlier on. It's strange that we are paths crossed again in that way. And I settled down there in January 1992 and had my main contact with NUTIS and the things that were going on there, a little bit of contact with Paul Jarvis and his team, but I was really left very free to choose my own line of work within the general theme of surface vegetation atmosphere transfer schemes. And I'd been interested for several years in the way in which all sorts of laboratory experiments appeared to show that stomata were sensitive to humidity, in particular to saturation deficit, in the sense that as saturation deficit increased, stomata tended to close. And it had worried me very much that people were using saturation deficit as a kind of surrogate for water demand, when nobody believed for a moment that leaves possessed a sensor for saturation deficit, or that there was anything in the leaf that directly responded to saturation deficit per se. And I began to see the light when I read a very interesting paper by two plant physiologists called Mott and Parkhurst, who'd done an extremely ingenious experiment where they had subjected leaves to air of different saturation deficit, and then had mixed up oxygen and helium to form a mixture which they called helox, which allowed them to change the saturation deficit and the transpiration rate independently. Really, one of these things you can think of, I wish I'd thought of that myself. And it was quite clear from the analysis that they did that leaves were not responding to saturation deficit per se, which was no big surprise to me, but they were responding to the flux of water. They were responding to the transpiration rate. And clearly it must be through the way in which transpiration rate changes water relations in the leaf and perhaps in the rest of the plant that the apparent effects of saturation deficit are mediated. So I then went back through all the evidence I could find for a saturation deficit response. There was, in most experiments, there was enough extra information to be able to calculate what the transpiration rate had been. And I found that in almost every case, there was a very simple and tight linear, negative linear relationship between stomatal conductance and transpiration rate. As the transpiration rate went up, stomatal conductance went down. And that, of course, allowed you to define a couple of parameters, one for the maximum conductance at zero transpiration and the other for maximum transpiration at zero conductance. And the whole thing became a neat little model. And subsequently, Roddy Dewar, whom, as you know, worked at Bush at that time, developed a nice little hydraulic plant-water relations model showing how that effect might come up. So that was the first part of the work I did on vegetation interactions, and then I started thinking, what about the other end of the system, the boundary layer end? And I looked at some of these calculations that Norton and Spriggs had done on the basis of their model, using the boundary layer measurements made in Eastern Holland by Driedonks, and one of the classic data sources, Driedonks' report, and discovered from that that you could express the relation between evaporation rate, or at least the Priestley-Taylor coefficient, and the surface resistance in much simpler terms than most people had been plotting it in the past. Norton and Spriggs and Jim Shuttleworth and various other people had plotted the Priestley-Taylor coefficient as a function of the logarithm of the surface resistance. Mm-hmm. Following, in fact, graph that I put in my 1985 paper, I think, when I'd used log of surface resistance just trying to straighten out what I thought was a otherwise rather curvaceous looking set of data.
The search for the straight line.
Well, the search for the straight line ultimately succeeded beyond my wildest expectations, because I discovered that if you plotted the Priestley-Taylor coefficient against the surface conductance and forgot all about this silly logarithmic function, you would get a hyperbola. And of course, if you invert the hyperbola, you get a straight line. So what I have now is a function where the reciprocal of the Priestley-Taylor coefficient is an absolutely perfect linear function of the surface resistance. And when I discovered this, I wrote to Keith McNaughton and said, what's going on? And he wrote back and said, I'm afraid I have no idea. So we've still got this very tight linear relationship, and the next thing is to try to discover why. Anyway, as I'll show in the seminar that I'm giving later on this morning, you've now got three relationships between conductance and transpiration. Penman-Monteith equation, the boundary layer relation I've just been talking about, and the physiological one. And if they are all true together, then of course you can make all sorts of interesting predictions about surface vegetation interactions using a very simple SPATS scheme.
Very nice the way that, you know, the scaling up looks like it might be a lot simplified.
Well, we'll see. As you know, I've always felt that you have to begin simple and then gradually complicate as the evidence dictated, rather than start complicated and get all bogged down and not really be able to test the experimental data properly.
You were also able to sort of pick up your connections again with the various learned societies and with conferences and that sort of activity in Europe, weren't you?
Yes, I was happy to do that because there were quite a number of people, of course, that I got out of touch with over the years in India. One of the first things that happened, we were both involved in the Sutton Bonington Easter School, which we had planned while I was still in India. And that was the first year I was back, I think, wasn't it, 1992?
We thought it might be your retirement, but it turned out not to be.
And that was on resource capture by crop plants, and we got a good list of speakers there, and the proceedings have just recently been published, and we were talking the other day about how nice that looks. The other society that I started attending the annual meetings of, almost by chance, was the European Geophysical Society, because it happened to be meeting in Edinburgh in 1992, and I'd never been involved with geophysicists at all, and hadn't realized quite the extent to which one of the sections of the European Geophysical Society was very concerned with the kind of work that was going on in Tiger, the whole business of climate change, responses of vegetation to the atmosphere, and vice versa. So I really enjoyed that meeting in Edinburgh, and as a result went to subsequent ones in Wiesbaden and in Grenoble. I've also done a bit of travelling abroad. I've been in Wageningen one or two times. I went to Copenhagen this year to help with the postgraduate course on evaporation, which was run by the geography department. I attended the joint meeting of the agrometeorology branch of the Royal Meteorological Society and its Irish equivalent in Dublin a few months ago, and that was an interesting experience. I never actually stayed in Dublin for more than a few days before. And now, of course, I have just been at the meeting of the American Society of Agronomy, again, a society whose meetings I've never attended before, but I was invited to join a small panel discussing the pros and cons of crop modelling. And that was quite fun, because it turned out...
Were you pro or con?
Well, I was pretty con, and it turned out that three out of four members of the panel were, so the one enthusiast for crop modelling got rather a hard time. But it was a good argument, and we all ended up in good-humoured disagreement, I think. So that's where we stand now. My support from Tiger comes to an end in a few days' time. And I've said I would be happy to have my name written in to the next phase, but that it would be quite immoral for me to continue taking any salary when there are lots of young people out there without jobs. And I'm able to draw my pension now, so I shall continue working as a man of independent means. And that means, of course, that I will probably not go in 5 days a week, but 3 or 2 days a week, depending how I feel.
Well, that really brings us right up to date now, John. And let's just finish up by looking back a little bit. Have you got any particular regrets about things that you haven't been able to do in this very full scientific career so far?
Yeah, I've got no regrets about the places that I worked and decisions I made about moves at particular times. That all worked out extremely well. I think my main regrets are really centred on the bits of work that never got properly finished. I suppose we all leave behind us as we move through life things that we wish we had rounded off. This comes back to the business of getting things done, and I did get a reasonable number of things done, but there were lots of measurements, for example in the Rothamsted days that I spoke about earlier, measurements that Geza and I took in the field, and we were really just swamped by them all, because in those days there were no quick ways of collecting and processing data as there are now, and a lot of the records were just on paper charts, extremely laborious to extract. And only a very, very small fraction of all that work was ever published. And I'm not trying to pass on responsibility for this, but one of the features, of course, was that in the physics department at Rothamsted, there was absolutely no pressure to publish. And there wasn't the same feeling that there is nowadays of publish or perish. And young people nowadays realize that they're not going to get any advancement in their careers unless they have a good publications record. This was never suggested during the time that I was working at Rothamsted. You had to generate your own drive. And it wasn't quite enough in my case, I'm afraid, to cope with all the backlog of data. When I went to Nottingham, I had great hopes of trying to catch up. But of course, I immediately got involved in more experimental work. And fortunately, most of that eventually saw the light of day, not the things that I'd done myself necessarily, but I think in the environmental physics section we had a pretty good record of publications, and we had that long list eventually of several hundred papers that were published during my time there.
Yes, I think we all benefited from this characteristic trait of yours, wanting to round things up.
Yeah.
So, when I'm still looking back, John, there must also be a lot of events that you look back on with a lot of satisfaction and happiness. I wonder if you'd just like to list a few of those sort of features of your life.
That's true. There are many events. And one of the most unexpected was my election to the Royal Society in 1971, when I was just 41 at that point, I think. And that came as an enormous surprise, and it still surprises me. Since then, there have been a number of other awards of different kinds. While I was at ICRISAT, I got a letter from the Rank Prize Funds one day to say that I'd been awarded a very handsome cash prize for crop husbandry and nutrition, which I thought was a rather strange thing for a pseudo-meteorologist to be receiving. And strangely enough, when I went to London to the big event that they staged at the Royal Society for this prize, there were one or two other people receiving prizes in different subjects, and John Horton and his team were there getting a prize for the development of the selective chopper radiometer. So it was quite a meteorological gathering after all. The other award which particularly delighted me was the honorary DSC from Edinburgh. So it was on a lovely sunny graduation day. I sat on the platform in the McEwen Hall with the sun streaming in through the windows of my borrowed red gown, and looked down at the place where I had sat 38 years previously to get my BSc. And that was a kind of coming full circle again. It was very rewarding. And talking of coming full circles, I was very, very pleased indeed to receive from Weather the James Peyton Prize for Photography a few years ago. James Peyton, of course, being the man who had first set my footsteps in the direction of meteorology. Just to remind you about that, when I was at ICRISAT the first time, I noticed a whole series of spectacular sunsets consisting of very bold rays of pinkish light that diverged from the distant horizon up to about half an hour after sunset, with dark blue areas in between. And when I started thinking about this, I was really rather baffled, because normally, of course, the sunset light disappears within half an hour of the sun's descending or so, and it was far, far brighter than that, and I just couldn't understand what was happening. And then it occurred to me that just possibly these rays were in fact caused by the sun striking the Western Ghats, which are about 400 kilometers away from Hyderabad, and I thought, oh, surely it can't be as far as that. But I brushed up some of my old geometry and worked it out, and sure enough, half an hour after sunset, the sun's rays would just be in the tangential to the Western Ghats. And if you think about it, you need to have irregularities of just the right scale to create a ray system. It wouldn't happen everywhere. If the irregularities were too large, they would completely occlude the sun's disk. And if they were too small, the sun's rays would just be broken up into little bits, and you still wouldn't see them. But somehow the ray size was just right. So I decided to try to take a series of photographs one night with my quite simple Bentek camera. And I relied entirely on the automatic exposure meter, which was quite a gamble, I think, and took photographs every 3 minutes as these rays appeared and disappeared again over a period of about half an hour or so. And I was very fortunate that the photographs on Kodachrome film came out extremely well, and I don't think anybody has ever produced a set like that before. Sent them into Weather with an article describing the geometry behind them, and a few months later got this letter to say that I'd won the Peyton Prize for Photography. So that was really very nice indeed. Just as a postscript to that, when we went back to ICRISAT, I thought, oh good, I'll be able to take lots more photographs of crepuscular rays. In 5 years, I only saw one very short, very poor display, although I looked for it nearly every night.
How interesting. So it's some feature of a dust in, at that time.
Exactly. It must the height of the rays that I'd worked out was corresponded with the bottom of the stratosphere, mm-hmm. and it was quite clear that, that the phenomenon is associated with stratospheric dust, which presumably has to be of a particular concentration and particle size distribution in order to get that effect. So I was very lucky not just to get the photographs, but to be there at the right time to see them as well. However, I've been talking about these various awards, and I'd like to round off, I think, by saying that the thing that gives me more satisfaction than any of these things is seeing people whom I've had some hand in training or working with during the years, making their own careers and succeeding in all sorts of different lines of work. I think that is one of the great rewards of teaching as distinct from research, is that you are brought into contact with a lot of young people, as students, as postgraduates, and as members of staff, who can be encouraged and sometimes helped to find appropriate ways of developing their careers, and then you lose touch with them for a little while, and when you come back again, you find that they have been promoted, and they are in important positions. You yourself, of course, ultimately succeeded me in the chair at Sutton Bonington, and that was a great source of satisfaction. And that's just one example among many of the people that I've worked with, and in some cases we both worked with, whom we now see in research institutes and educational establishments in Britain and in other parts of the world, who are playing quite major roles in the whole question of environmental science and climate change, for example. That's most gratifying.
Well, I'm glad that you finished up with that, because if you hadn't said so, I was going to say a word sort of on behalf of all the many sort of students and colleagues you've had, because I think it is quite remarkable what an influence you've had on a lot of people's lives, and how many of us have gained a lot in terms of our careers through working with you and seeing the way that you did science and got excited about different features. Not only, I think, that we sort of gained in that sense, but it was also tremendous fun, wasn't it?
We all had a great
time in that.
Yes, that's right, we did, and there are lots of good times to look back on. I suppose that the reason for it is, and the reason why I've enjoyed particularly working alongside people, comes back to the kind of person I am as revealed by these curious tests that I talked about, that I really am, in the end of the day, more interested in people than in things, and the intuitive bit I have used in order to investigate the natural world and the physical aspects of the natural world, but it's been the human contacts that have always been more important to me in the end, and that is why that aspect of it does give me so much satisfaction. I've been conscious, going through this story, which we've been sitting chatting over now for about a couple of hours, of the number of times when I've said, by happy accident, something has happened, and really it's not accidental. I'm sure that God has guided me through the years, and that I can't take any personal credit for the things that I have achieved. He has given me particular gifts, particular skills, a particular personality, and I have tried to make the most of these and to follow the way in which I think he has wanted me to move on different occasions. I haven't always been successful, I haven't always followed his way very loyally, but I've tried, and I hope that that perhaps is the most appropriate note for me to end on.
John, thank you very much. I've enjoyed doing that tremendously, and I'm grateful to the Royal Meteorological Society for asking us to do it.
It's been really interesting. I didn't realise when we started that it was going to take quite so long, but I think we've been pretty thorough, and no doubt we'll think about things afterwards that we should have said, but let's leave it at that. Thank you very much for your very helpful and friendly interrogation, Mike.
Thank you.